Lecture 9, Christmas Seminar, Next Step, Illumination. I am spiritually illumined. Lecture 9, Stories from the Bible. The Bible is the source of a lot of very wonderful and very beautiful things that give us a lot to think about. But one of the big things we want to recognize about the Bible is that the Bible is a story of the religious development of a people. The Bible is not something that we want to just take for verbatim and for granted, because it is a revised book, it is a rewritten book, it is a book that had the opportunity for many, many errors in it. However, it is an inspired book. It is a book that has guided many the people of its culture, the Hebrew culture, through the years to achieve a certain amount of greatness. One thing that we think of the Hebrew culture as being is to be a very, very successful financial organization. You know, it's like the Catholic Church, very successful financially. Well, the Jews are known for their ability to make money and make it grow and make it do things. Of course, the Chinese aren't bad either. They do that very well too. But they don't do it as overall as the Jews do. Now, the Bible is a story of the religious development of the people. It tells how the people came to points of important awareness inside of themselves and how they handled it. Now, Christina, I hope you're paying close attention to the fact that you are a master.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you said before you had a problem, and then you left the problem behind, and I haven't heard it since. Right? Now, that's being a master, right?
Yes.
Just remember, this is what you're supposed to do. We're always supposed to be a master. Now, Christina, I am going to expect that you're going to take this mastership home with you and apply it in your world, in your family, in your life, okay? 100%.
Yes.
Okay. You're welcome. But a lot of times we just don't notice it. We speak our word and the results take place, but we don't pay attention that it happens, you know? And we must not necessarily give ourselves credit for it, but we must be aware that we were the ones who did it. So you spoke your word, and you brought the results. I merely gave you a good swift kick in the butt, you know. You're welcome. Anytime. My foot's always available. Okay. Now, Jesus had the same hang-up. Same problem that I have with you guys. Yeah, he was a little more skilled at it or whatever than I, but he said so many things to his disciples, and he offered them so many suggestions, and so often they didn't follow directions. He told them to go out and preach and teach and heal, you know, and they went out and they tried it. But because he wasn't standing next to them, they weren't successful. Then he said, go again, and go again, and go again. He didn't just say a couple times, he said a lot. Because they were a little bit flaky about the whole thing. They were not really ready to go and be responsible. But he was ready to have them be responsible. So he sent them out again and again, and he went with them. Now, we don't have the stories of all this sort of thing, but there were 24 hours in the day that Jesus was with his disciples. Sometime he slept, that's true. But while he was with his disciples, he was working, just like I do with you guys. And he took them into the dens of iniquity. He took them into the hospitals. He took them into the leper colonies. He took them into all areas. And he did not do the healing. He had them do the healing. He wanted them to see that they actually could do it. And this is what I do with all of you on a little gentler slope. Because healing is not necessarily our greatest forte, although it's important. Our greatest forte, our greatest impact, is that we be ourselves and have fun. Be ourselves. Not go out and change the world, not go out and help the world. We be ourselves. And in the process, the world is improved by our presence. The world is lifted up as we are lifted up. And we must be aware of that too. Because if we're not aware that the world is lifted up, then we haven't followed any of those teachings at all. Now, as he would go out with his disciples, and as he would take them to the leper colonies and to the hospitals of such as they were in those days, they would come in there and they would find everything in disarray, as it was. Everything was out of order. The things that they changed for the wounds on the injured people, the diseased people, they had no concept of sanitation. They had no concept of having clean cloths and you know, washing their hands before. That didn't come until almost 2,000 years later, at least 1,700 years later, when the medical society began taking note of that. But he made this statement here, which I thought was quite good. He said, clean, Mark 7:19.
I didn't bring a
dictionary. I didn't bring a Bible along. But what he had said in there, is there a Bible in there? What he had said at Mark 7:19, thank you. And you can all, I don't think that's a Bible.
That's not a Bible.
That
Bible
is a
handbook.
That's the Bible handbook. That's not the Bible. As he was saying, it's not what goes into man, but not, it's not 7:19. It's not what goes into the mouth, but but what comes out.
Holy Bible.
Holy Bible. Bring it here and I'll flash it open. Okay, that's, oh, this is by George Lanza. This is one of the
exquisite.
Yeah. This is what I was looking at in my house too. What? 7:19. Mark 7:19. Okay. And there's 8 and there's 7. 7:19. We have to go a little before that. Who has ears to hear, let him hear. When Jesus entered into the house because of the people, his disciples asked him concerning that parable. The parable was, we'll go on here. Oh yeah, there it is. There is nothing outside of man, if it should enter into him, which can defile man. But what goes out of him, that defiles man. Nothing that we take into our bodies, nothing we eat, nothing we drink, nothing we have experiences with, not even any illnesses, they do not defile our body. Only what goes out of the body, what goes out as we speak, and that's primarily what he was speaking about. And he said to them, so even you find it hard to understand. Do you not know that whatever enters into a man from the outside cannot defile him? Because it does not enter into his heart, but into his stomach, and then is thrown out through the intestines, thereby purifying the food. It is what goes out of man which defiles the man. And again, he wasn't speaking of the food that he ate. For from within, from the hearts of men, come evil thoughts, such as fornication, adultery, theft, murder, extortion, wickedness, deceit, lust. He had a lot of them there. And evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness, and all the evils come from within, and they defile the man. And this is what was something that many people just could not get with. They couldn't get with the concept that it's not what goes in to man, because they were teaching diet, they were teaching good health, they were teaching all sorts of interesting things, and in teaching these things, made them look like they're paramount. It's like the Jews who say that you cannot have unclean food. Well, I think it's charming. I think it's very charming. The rabbis go into the slaughterhouses and they bless the meat, and then it's killed, and then you can eat it. Then it's sanctified meat. Well, now, that's cool. But you also can sanctify your food. Mm-hmm. You also can sanctify your meat. You also can sanctify anything, because the Bible says so. And this is an interesting thing, but it goes beyond that. It goes beyond that. Jesus used the term, it is done unto us according to our belief. What is your belief about the food? Do you think food is good for you? Do you think all food is noble and beautiful and good for you? Do you think that food is going to make you strong or weak or healthy or sick? Do you think that food is going to benefit your body in any way? Well, whatever you believe, that's what you're going to experience. I tell the story of the two Hindu mothers living in two separate communities where they were starving. They just did not have enough to eat. And they were down to their last cup of white rice. And so the one mother said to her child, "Sweetheart, I love you, and this is the last bit of food we have, and there is no more." They ate the food and they died. And then another mother in another village said to her son, she said, "Son, this is the last rice we have in the house, but it is not our real food. Our real food comes from in our heart, and we will live on and we will live through this experience. We do not have to die. We will find a way, and we do not have to die. We will eat just a little food and we will be fine. And when we have a lot, we'll eat a lot." And she and her child lived. For some reason or other, they were able to pass through this terror of the night where there was not enough food, where there was not enough of anything for the family, and they were doing just great, you see? They were doing just great. But the thing is, it was in their consciousness. It was in their thought. It was in their mind. Now, we know in Africa, these people who live on the plains and who live in very humble circumstances, they love rice. And they eat rice in super abundance. And we did too. And other things that they had, I think they were putting on a little show for us by having a lot of other things, but a lot of rice, a lot of rice. And rice is a staple that grows in the area, and it is not too expensive. They can afford it quite well. And they love it. And this is their major food, the major food. And they know that in that rice is every bit of energy, every bit of vitamin, mineral, and vegetable, and so that they might need in their body. And they're fantastic. They're happy with it. You understand? They believe that this is adequate for them. And it is. Now, it's true that some of them may come down with some sort of diseases that might need additional vitamins or minerals or things to support the body. But basically, they have sufficiency. Basically, they have enough. Now, in Hebrew times, they did the same thing. They didn't have rice necessarily, but they had the grains, and they had bread. And, you know, we are so accustomed to it that we think that everybody has vegetables, carrots, and peas, and corn, and other things on their plate. We think that everybody has beans, and that they have rice, and that they have bread, and that they have potatoes. And the most naive thing of all that we think is that the people of the world eat a lot of meat. They do eat a lot of meat. But it's not the people of the world that eat a lot of meat. It's a few people of the world that eat a lot of meat. Because most of the people do not have meat to eat. You think they're vegetarians by choice? They're vegetarians it's because it's not there. And probably if they would eat meat, that wouldn't bode them too well because they're not having their bodies prepared for it. But again, the Bible tells you this statement, and Jesus reports this statement too. So often, it's not what goes into the mouth, but what comes out of the mouth that defiles the man. And this is tremendously important. It's tremendously important for us to realize that if we say food is so important, if we say we must have certain foods, we must have certain things, then we are possessed by that. Whereas if we say, "I choose my food wisely, that pleases me and delights me, go for it, you know. But if you say, I must have this or I won't have the proper dietary things in my body, I must have that, and that, well, you're very foolish. Because you are limiting yourself by someone else's opinion. I doubt that any of us have ever taken a course in dissecting food products and finding which ones have the vitamins in, finding which ones have the minerals in, finding which ones have the protein and the carbohydrates and stuff like that. And none of us have ever done that. None of us have ever gone deeply in, we don't want to figure out what these foodstuffs have in them. And the reason that we don't do it is because we just believe in what's written on the package or what we've heard in the book. You know, what these people who make a living doing that have written. And I find this a very important thing. Whatever a scientist writes today, another scientist will write tomorrow and be just the opposite. And then another scientist will write a short time later and bring up something new, and bring up something which will relegate the previous two concepts into the bush, you know? Because we must follow what our own heart tells us and what our own mind tells us. We must listen to the Bible within us. I was going to tell you stories from the Bible, and I will, but basically, the Bible that we want to read is the Bible that's within us. That's the manual that came, and it's on the hard disk inside of us. And all we have to do is access that manual, right, Gertrude?
Yes.
And when we access it, it's on PDF file, so it is easily taken off and easily moved around, easily changed, you know, PDF file. And it's a very special software type of file for utilizing large documents and having them so they don't eat up your computer. It's a very wonderful program that Adobe put out, right? And it's very excellent, very excellent. I'm learning how to use it. And I have seen it used, but I haven't quite used it myself yet. But I'm working on it. But in there, it has the book of your life. It has the book of what is good for you. Now, as I told you, we had these four young kids up on the ranch, and three of them came from a family of redheads and fair-skinned children who were told they were lactose intolerant, and they were told that they couldn't tolerate the sun, and they were told they couldn't eat certain vegetables. And so, as far as the milk went, I said, hey, this milk up here in the mountain is wonderful milk. It is different from any milk you'd ever get in the city. It's the kind of milk that'll just make your body say, howdy, you know, and you'll just want more and more and more. And they did. They ended up loving milk. They went home from here drinking milk like it was going out of style. And then they were told by their doctors and their mother and so on, don't play in the sun without a lot of clothing on. Cover your arms and cover everything. And I told them, the sun up on the mountain is not like the sun in the city, which has all that smog and fog and stuff. The sun up on the mountain is clear and crystal and beautiful, and it just touches your body and kisses your body and says, I love you, I love you, I love you, and tans you in just no time at all. Well, they believed me. And they went out playing in their play pool, you know, these little pools, and naked as jaybirds, running around, couldn't get them to put on clothes. They just were so happy, and in no time, they were brown as birds, brown as bears, just happy as could be. And when their mother came up and saw them, she said, my goodness, what, that's impossible. And then the father came up too, and he was having dinner with us, and the father said, no, no, I don't want any broccoli, I don't want any broccoli. And of course the kids immediately said, I don't want any broccoli either. And so I said to the father, here on the ranch, everyone eats a little bit of everything. And broccoli here is something very special. You should give it a try here. I think when you taste it up here on the mountain, you'll find that it has a flavor that you've never experienced before. And so the father tried it, and he finished it, knowing that he had to be a good boy. And the kids all ate it because Daddy ate it. And I told him later, I said, nobody ever says they don't eat something up on the ranch. Because it's hard enough getting the kids to like it without having their parents not like it, and then they don't like it because their parents don't like it. But he got the message, and he was very cooperative. But, you see, this is how it goes. We have all of these things that come out of tradition. Now, you know the story about the Hebrews who were coming down with, trichinosis and so forth, you know. And it was kind of tough. And the rabbis had no idea what was going on. They were the medical doctors, you know. They had no idea what was going on. And so they prayed. And he said, God, what shall we do? And God spoke to them right from the center of their being and said, don't eat any more swine. Now, God said, don't eat any more swine until they have gone through their cycle and are free of trichinosis. But they're like the boy who wanted to kiss the girl across the street, and he says, God, can I kiss her? And God says, sure. And then the girl slammed him across the street, and he says, God, I thought you said I could kiss her. Yeah, I did, but you didn't listen for the rest of it. I said, if you do, she'll slam you across the street. Now, this is the same with the Hebrews and the rabbis. They didn't listen to what God had to say totally. And so they made a tradition out of a condition that was temporary. And so one of the very accessible meat products that they had of hogs and swine was no longer available to them. How interesting, you know? Mm-hmm. So they did not eat swine from that day on. And the Catholics, what do they do? They only eat fish on Fridays, you know. And they won't eat anything else. But man, I don't mind eating fish every day. You know? And it's interesting, when you can't have something, you want it with all your heart. Even though you haven't got a great interest in it. You want it because you can't have it. But traditions are born that way. And conditions are born that way. And of course, I'm sure many of the Jews eat swine today because it is proven to be, you know, I'm sure their rabbis have gone out and blessed the swine and changed that condition. But it's a meaningful thing. It's a way of manipulating the people, a way of controlling them. They had to say, no swine, because they knew from God within that the swine were killing the people with the trichinosis, and they had to stop it. And they did, and it did, and it went its way. But you see, these are a lot of interesting stories that come to us through the Bible, through the teachings of these people, through these men who are working on behalf of the people. And they're prophets. They're good ones, too. Because they didn't have any research laboratory. They didn't have any medical society. They didn't have any organizations that send them on their computer the answer to any question that they have. They had to go direct to the source. They had to go to God within them. They couldn't even go to God without them, because they couldn't get to the temple all the time. And the only place God without was found was in the temple. And so then they had to just sit in quiet meditation. What shall I do? And then the booming voice says, you know, Buster, what you should do. You should do this. And you know, as I was looking in the Bible and I saw the word God, it was capitalized all the way through the Bible. And then I looked in the dictionary, and it's lowercase all the way through the dictionary. Because the dictionary is not a Christian dictionary. It is a universal dictionary. It has Buddhism, it has Hinduism, it has Judaism, it has, you name it, it's got it. So they cannot say that God is defined as the universal first principle, first cause, the formator of the universe, all these good things, you know. All these things representing the deity, that which is something a little beyond what we might have known. However, they did say that individual religious groups did capitalize the name of their deity. Now, what do the Indians call their god?
Shiva.
That is a very interesting slip of the lip there, Ellen.
She would love that.
I know. Patricia Shifdad is one of our ministers.
Oh, okay.
and one of our good students. She's quite excellent and quite effective. She has been doing healings that are outstanding. And many of the Hindus have, I even forgot what I was going to talk about there. Many of the Hindus were working with God, and they have God for every purpose. They have a God of this and a God of that. And the Greeks, how many gods do they have? My God, they have a lot of gods. And who is their chief God for the Greeks?
Zeus.
Zeus? Yeah. Juno? Jupiter? Zeus? Zeus, huh?
Wasn't he underwater?
I'm sorry, no. Underwater. No, that was another one. But anyhow, they had lots of gods. And their gods were quite interesting. And they were for every purpose. They were for purposes of the crops, of fertility, of prosperity, of health, of, you name it. They got music, dance, and strength, and power, and neat stuff. And you see, what we have done as a semi-Christian nation, and I say semi-Christian because if we were really Christian, we would believe the universal Christ that's in us, in all people, and we would live that. But we still like to say, oh God, and we hold up our hands to pray to a God outside of us. And we think, oh God, guide me and direct me. We're thinking of a God that is not in 100% contact with us all the time. And we want to always know that God is in 100% contact with us. Because God is in us, as us, through us. And we are God. Which is a tough thing to say. Although Jesus taught that very specifically throughout the Bible, throughout the New Testament, his four Gospels. He taught that. But even though he said it, most ignore it. And they ignore it because it's like letting your meal ticket get away from you. If people don't need the church, if they don't need a minister or a priest to give them the sacraments and so forth, and they can do it themselves, why would they give a donation to the church? They give the donation to themselves. That's another 10% in your pocket, more or less. And today, the 10% is not considered proper. When you, they should have tithe, not tithe, but tithe. What's 20% as a tithe? If tithe is 10%, what's 20%?
Tithe.
Tithe.
Yeah. Twice. So,
huh?
Twice.
Twice. But you see, the religious, the story of a people. Now, what is it that we're going to do? In Europe, you don't tithe. They take. The government takes it and gives it to the church and says, get out of our hair, you know? And because, you know, the churches used to be pretty rough. The churches would have people come to the churches and they would say, you must do this, you must do that. Now, for penance, you got to build a new tower, you got to do this here, and if you're a bricklayer, you got to do that, you got to work your heart out. And they had to build a lot of really nice buildings for them. But the thing is, the government got a little tired of that. They wanted the money to go into government buildings. And so, therefore, they cut the church back to what it originally had asked for. See, the church was foolish. It should have asked for 90% and given 10% to the people, and they could have lived very happily on 10%. And the church could have lived very happily on 90%. But the Catholic Church became a very wealthy church through the 10%. And it today is doing very well. So think of those things. Think of those things. Where does the concept of illumination come from in the Bible? Where does the concept of illumination? Well, from the very beginning. You see, in about 440 B.C., Abraham was doing his thing according to biblical scholars. Other biblical scholars say it's 5,000 years, and others say it's 4. But 444 B.C. was when Abraham was doing it. He was supposed to be the father of the people. And he was going to sacrifice his son, his chosen son, because God said, sacrifice him. This is Abraham speaking to himself, of course, because nobody heard God say that to Abraham, but only Abraham. So it must have been a pretty good connection he had. So he took his son, his favorite son, tied him up, put him on the altar, and was ready to light the fire. And then God said, because you believe so completely, you may untie your son, and there's a ram stuck in the bush. Go get him and put him on the altar. Now, isn't that a logical, understanding God that's speaking there? Isn't that a wonderful thing? Now, what do you think really was the story that was being done there? The story that was really being done there, quite likely, was that his favorite son was getting a little antsy-pantsy. He was becoming mature. He was showing his hormones. And Daddy wanted to keep him around and keep him under his control. But he had to scare the bejabbers out of the kid to get him to stay home and to pay attention to what he wanted him to do. So he said that God said he had to do this. And the kid knew his father loved him, and so he wasn't too shook up by it because he knew that at the last minute something would come along. But the father, he went right along with it because he knew the script. He knew he wasn't going to do it. So both of them ended up there. And you know what the son ended up doing? Going off and doing his own thing. He decided he didn't really like the way his father was handling the thing. So he went off and did his own thing. Now, Moses, on the other hand, was quite interesting too. Moses, as you know, was born in Egypt. And his mother tried to save his life when the Pharaoh said, kill them all. And the Pharaoh's own daughter picked up Moses from the reeds, we read. And there's a lot of shenanigans going on in there. People knew what was going on. And so Moses ended up being the Pharaoh's favorite because he was a bright boy. Most of the Jewish boys are pretty sharp kids, you know. And money-wise and business-wise. And Moses helped his father, so to speak, to come to some pretty heavy grips with himself. But then, as happens, he killed somebody and he had to face the penalty, which meant death for him, and that meant he had to get out of the country. So he ran away. See, he ran away instead of facing the music and saying, okay, I did it. I did it because of these reasons, and if that's not good enough, then kill me, that's okay. But he ran away because he knew that there was more adventure coming for him. And he went off to the desert and he married a lovely, lovely girl who had a lovely, lovely wealthy father. And they had a lovely, lovely home in the desert with lots of critters that he took care of. And then one day, after being there for how many years?
40 years.
40 years in the desert, 40 years away from the king. And he must have been 40 years old when he left, too. So for 40 years, he had a family. And he raised a lot of kids, and he had a lot of good things going. And then he goes up in the mountain, and God speaks to him and says, Mo, I got a job for you. And he said, well, what's that? You got to go free my people from the Pharaoh in Egypt. And Moses said, well, I can't do that because I've got a cleft lip. Because when my dad, the Pharaoh, said to me one time, what do you want? Do you want a hot coal or do you want a piece of gold? And so my dad gave me the hot coal and a piece of gold. But the gold was also hot. And I put it in my mouth and it burned my lip. And I haven't been able to speak properly ever since then. I got to this and that. And so God says, hey, that's okay, your brother Aaron, he's got a gift of gab that, you know, mountain wide, and so we'll let him come and speak on your behalf. And so Aaron did. He went with Moses to Egypt and did this. Just dumped his wife, dumped his children, dumped his farm, dumped everything, and Aaron must have done the same thing. Aaron probably had a family too. They don't talk about that. And then they went dashing off to see the Pharaoh in Egypt and have a good time. And they did that. But you see, he listened to that inner illumination, which he said was God, and that's great. And then he went through all of the experiences that you remember reading of the Red Sea and the parting of the waters later and turning the the river into blood and having all the firstborn killed of the Hebrews, which is a foolish waste of young people, but it was good because they were born in slavery and the next batch was going to be born on the road. And so he went out and went with the people through the river, through the Red Sea, and he was on the other side freed. Well, it was only about a two-day trip, maybe two-and-a-half-day trip, if they went straight through. But they took the sightseeing train, they took the milk train, they stopped here and stopped there and stopped here for 40 years. They just had a ball for 40 years. Meanwhile, most of the older people died off. The older people who were upset with the way the Pharaoh had been good to them as far as they were concerned, they wanted to stay there. And the younger people, they didn't have any opinion yet. And so they went along with Moses, and Moses kept training him in the concept of one God. And then when Moses came to the Holy Land, he went up on the mountain, and he held up his arms, and he said, as long as I hold my arm up, you will be able to pass in to the Holy Land without anybody stopping you. And so Moses held his arm up, and his friends came and helped him hold it up. They built a log under his arm to hold it up. And he held it up, and the people got through. He was not allowed to get into the Holy Land because he had not followed God's prescription perfectly. So Moses, at that point in time, just walked away and disappeared. Just like Quetzalcoatl. Just walked into the ocean and disappeared, because Moses walked into the desert and he was gone. Never found, no bones, no nothing. Which is understandable too. But you see, these are great stories. These are great images. And they're great telling stories too. And we could, of course, recount many, many, many of them. We could talk about many of these stories from many points of view. But what is the major point of view of the stories? The major point of view is that you must admit, I must admit, that there was nobody around, except when Jesus was baptized and the dove came down and said, hey, this is a cool boy, you know, you're my beloved son. And Jesus was the son of a dove. That was neat. That was really neat. And so I have, you say, Herb, you're being sacrilegious, you're being, you know, anti-Christ. No, I'm not. I like the guy. I think everything he did was just super, and I think that we don't always understand what he did, but he did great stuff. And he never touted his own horn. He merely said, the Father and I, we do these things. The divine in me. But why didn't he say, just divine? Why didn't he say, I am God only to the people? Because the people were Hebrews, and they were coming out of that teaching. And if he were to just say, I am God, and so forth, they would have killed him sooner, you know? And that way he would have never got his message caught in any way. But this is the fun thing about reading the Bible. If you read the Bible and understand the Bible in its more gentle way, without being so severe about it, without being so categorical about it, say, it's got to be this way, it takes the fun out of it. But when you do this, it puts the fun into it. I told you the story about the camel and the needle's eye. Remember that? The Bible has it that it is easier for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than it is for a camel to enter a needle's eye. And do you know what the needle's eye is?
No.
Help me. The needle's eye is a side entrance coming into the community of any Jewish community. And it's built like this, very narrow, so that men can walk through with their tools. And then there's a loop up above so that the camel can carry the grain back from the field. But the loop is only big enough for the grain to come back, not for the camel to carry a big load of goodies to be sold in the community. That's got to go through the front gate, which is allowed, and you pay taxes on that. And then you can sell it. But you see, they try to snicker in through the side gate. And the camel cannot go through the needle's eye, the side gate, carrying a big load like that, because it just won't fit. But the farmer goes through there okay. And then you remember the story of Jesus saying, if a child asked for bread, would his father give him a stone? And if a child asked for a fish, would his father give him a serpent? Now, what that meant was, in those days, they had a big pile of stones outside the front of the house, and they would bake their bread in those stones. The stones would retain the heat in a balanced way, and the bread would bake very nicely around the stones. And oftentimes, they would pick up a stone inadvertently for a loaf of bread, because they were both heavy. The unleavened bread and the leavened bread that they had was very heavy in those days. And then, as far as the fish, they would hang the fish to dry from the ceiling of their home. That was their refrigerator. And so, at night, when it was dark, and Mama was working at the stove, and she says, bring me a couple of fish. He just reached up there and grab a couple of fish hanging there and take them over to her. Well, occasionally, there were good serpents hanging from the ceiling, too, who were eating the flies and other vermin that were crawling around, and they liked them. But Mama didn't ask for a snake when she asked for fish for feeding the family. But these are stories that are very fascinating, very, very colorful. I have a couple hundred more, but I like to tell the same ones again because perhaps maybe you will take time to read the others in the book. What is the title of the book, Ellen?
The Lamsa Bible.
Hmm?
The Lamsa Bible.
No. That it's in there too. But what's the title of these books? We have the New Testament and the Old Testament. It was written by Lamsa, and it tells all of the biblical stories and what they mean. It's quite an excellent book. And what do you think you remember it? But we have had it in our library many times, and then every time I'd go to look for it, it got moved. Somebody else was reading it, apparently. But they're very good books, and they give you a lot of good background into biblical lore, into biblical stories, into biblical life, and especially at that time. The language of the people at that time was Aramaic. And the Aramaic language, I understand, was a very simplistic language. It had very few words that were used to say a lot. And whenever you wanted to have a word say something different, you'd put different words, different accents on it. And so then the word would say something different. And the same word for beheaded and the same word for wise, beheaded and wise are the same word in Aramaic, except the wise has a little dot underneath it. And if the wise isn't there, then they're being beheaded. But it can be a very confusing but a very wonderful experience. I was at the University of Chicago in the Chicago Theological Seminary, and across the street from us, they were doing research on the books that they found in the desert there. They brought them in. And what were they called?
Scripts.
Hmm? The seam scroll in part, but it's the that's close enough. What?
Covenant.
Yeah, I know. Not Kabbalah, but it's
covenant.
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 Covenant. No, no.
Covenant.
No, it's the name of the area from which the scrolls, in which the scrolls were found. But it's very fascinating.
Dead Sea.
Hmm?
But Dead Sea.
Red Sea.
Dead.
Dead Sea scrolls. Yeah, that's given to it occasionally too. But these scrolls were found on the hillside by a shepherd boy, and he brought them home to his mother and said, look, we have firewood. And so they used them in their fires, and they used them for quite a while. And then a traveler came along and saw them and recognized what they were. And, ooh, my goodness, don't burn another one. You know, they're worth, you know, we'll put you up in a great hotel forever rather than burning those things. But they brought them out, and they were quite consistent with the Old Testament, the New Testament, as we have read it. And, of course, there's always stories behind these things and reasons for them being done, because look, if a dozen men from a dozen countries who do not know each other can all come up with a light bulb at the same time, likewise with coming up with an automobile engine, likewise with coming up with many other inventions at the same time, surely they could come up with writing the New Testament,
yeah,
you know, in those scrolls type of thing. It's just a thought, but it's a good one, because we want to say, why, how miraculous, how strange. That's true, it is miraculous, and it is strange, but it is not so strange when you look at it and compare it to other factual things. It's very interesting, this factual world that we live in. I told you the story about Peter and Paul, and that Mary wasn't involved, but Peter, Paul, and Mary are a song team, you know. But Peter and Paul were in absolute competition with one another. Peter was the right hand of Jesus, you know, and the rock upon which his church was to be founded, and Paul was the cross upon which Jesus was placed. And Saul was. And finally, Saul had his conversion, his illumination. And how do we know he had the illumination? He merely told those people he was riding with on their horses, "I can't see anymore, I can't see anymore." You know? And, well, why can't you see? I don't know. You know, maybe it was a dust storm. But he couldn't see anymore. And he tells the story that it was an illumination, and a good illumination. But why was he, one of the detractors certainly of Jesus, brought out to be his supporter, his proponent? Well, he was. And he went to Peter, and he says, "Well, Pete, here I am. I'm on your team." And Peter says, "No, you are not." He says, "I don't want any competition. I'm number one, and I don't want anybody around here intellectual like you are. You take over the show in no time. You take the other side of the street, the other side of the Mediterranean, and you go over there and preach and teach and heal, and you do your thing, and I'll do mine over here." Well, they came to odds many times, but Paul did cover the other side of the Mediterranean, because that was the side that Peter was not running after. Peter very seldom left home. To leave home in those days was quite a chore. You didn't have a car, you didn't have horses or chariots or other things. You had to walk most of the time. And this is why, in those days, people found it difficult to take suitcases with them. And so, rather than taking suitcases with them, they wore everything. If they wore underwear at all, they wore it all. If they had trousers, they put them all on at once. They'd have maybe two or three pair of trousers. And they'd have cloaks and coats and shirts. And this is why Jesus said to him, if a robber comes to you and wants to take your coat, give him your coat and give him your cloak also, which is under your coat. Give him whatever he wants. And then the presumption went on, your life is surely worth more than the clothing that you are carrying with you. But this was how they did things in those days. They wore everything, and they wore their shoes. They usually just had one pair of shoes, if at all. And as Jesus said, go into all of the communities that you go into. And if the community doesn't accept the teaching that you're giving to them, kick the dust off your feet and go on your way. Don't be upset with the community, just go on. You'll find plenty who will accept it. And he did. He found many who accepted it, and they were just utterly fantastic. So, we have covered a few of these things here. They're kind of fascinating. I think that the story we might just conclude here with is the story about A&E. And Adam and Eve were a joyous couple. They were if you will, God's first experiment at human creation, you know. But he created everything else. He did a good job. He knew how to create rabbits and dogs and cats and fish and everything else. And he came to man, and he made a mistake with man. In man, God gave all of his wisdom, all of his knowledge, all of the understanding of good and bad, of truth and falsehood and stuff. And then he tried to take it back. And he took it back by saying, all the knowledge of good and evil is in the apples in this tree. And you're not supposed to eat of that apple tree. But Eve, or Adam didn't have the curiosity Eve had. Eve was a very curious and a very outgoing lady, you know. She wanted to do everything. If you don't believe me, you read Mark Twain's story or get the videotape from Mark Twain on Adam and Eve. It is a story that will set you back on your ear, because Eve really knew where it was at, and she was doing it good. Adam used to come home from fishing or wherever, and there was Eve sitting with a baby. And he says, how'd you get the kid? Where'd he come from? You know, no idea, you know, no idea. And she says, oh, I found him in the lake here. Well, throw him back. We don't want any kids around here. And she says, no, I'm keeping him. And so she kept him. And she kept him twice like that. And he says, my God, can I walk away from here 10 minutes without you popping up with a new baby, you know? But he got accustomed to the kids and got to like them and became a reasonably good father. But that's the story that Mark Twain tells, and I think it's as charming as can be. And it's just as true as it is false. It is just as true as anything else is true or anything else is not true.
That's right.
Now, is there any Bible story that comes to your mind right now that you would like to get an impression from me on? Any Bible story at all. It doesn't matter.
To the woman, it's a riddle.
Go. You want to know about the harlot at the well?
Oh.
Okay. Well, the harlot was at the well. And harlot means a woman who sells her her favors for money, you know. And she was at the well getting water. And Jesus came to her. And Jesus said, may I have some water, please? And she says, you don't want water from me. I'm a bad woman. And Jesus, yes, I know. Yes, I know. You've been sleeping with every man in town, and you have been running around, just being a pain in the neck to all the women, because you're making it difficult for them to keep up with being attractive to their husbands, you know. And if you don't stop it, you will create a great problem for yourself. Well, just then, the men from the village came up. And the men from the village came up and said, oh, my goodness, she'll tell him everything, and then we're in trouble. And so, as they're supposed to do, anyone who is violating the principle is supposed to be stoned to death. So the men picked up stones, and they were going to stone the woman to death. And then Jesus said, what is the problem here? And they said, well, she's a harlot. And Jesus said, very good. Now, those among you who are without sin may cast the first stone. And so all the guys put the stones down and left. Because they knew they were just as much involved as she was. And then the woman turned to Jesus and said, what am I going to do, Lord? And he says, go and sin no more. Stop doing those things that are getting you in trouble. Go and sin no more. So she went and sinned no more. And we haven't heard a thing about her in 2,000 years. But who knows? All of the... obviously she didn't have any children. Maybe she did later, you know. Like in Siddhartha, where Siddhartha's girlfriend had the baby. And the baby was quite a boy. And she finally woke up to the fact that she loved him, and she was looking for him. He's already an old man. And she was looking for him. And on the way, she squatted down to drain, and an adder bit her, and she died. And so the son finally found the father and went on with his life. But you see, why was she bit? If she had awakened to this, I mean, she was a good part of the story. She was a very dominant part of the story as a very wonderful expression of a magnificent woman, yes?
The son even ran away with a little money they had earned in bringing the people on the other side of the arena. So, the son disappeared.
I didn't hear well what you said, but I presume you said that the son was earning money taking people across in the boat?
It was the
father? The mother? Anybody?
His father, that was a...
His father was working with an old man who was taking the boats back and forth.
Yes.
The old man died.
Yes.
And the father continued, who was Siddhartha, he continued taking people back and forth across the river. And then the son came and helped him to a point, or was a pain in the neck or whatever. But you've read the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating story. So, did you have a question about that?
No.
Okay. So, any other comments? Any other biblical questions?
Yeah, the questions with the angel announcing the birth of Jesus.
Yeah? And what is your question?
What's the symbol of it? You know, and it must have been Mary who heard that as a divine voice.
Mary was probably a very fine lady, girl. And she became pregnant. Now, she may have been impregnated by the divine spirit. Everybody calls it the divine spirit when they impregnate. But she may have been impregnated by the divine spirit, or she may have had a liaison that resulted in a child. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, this is only Mary's story. She's the only one who knew it and said it. She said, God came to me, and he said that I will have a son, and his name will be Jesus, and he will be a holy child. Well, now, this is cool. This is real cool. We should all do that with our children. Say that our children are divinely born, divinely inspired, divinely brought forth. So, then Mary goes to her buddy, Joseph, and says, I'm pregnant, and I'm going to have a child, and if I don't find someone who will take me, I will be stoned to death, and I don't want to be stoned to death before he's born. So Joseph says, well, Mary, you're a good kid. I'll back you up. I'll stay with you. So Joseph stayed with Mary and her child by another source. And so they prepared themselves to have the baby, and they had the baby. Apparently it was their first. Would you say it was their first?
Yes.
Because she was presumably a virgin. And so then they had about five more.
Oh.
Well, you know that.
Yeah.
Jesus was in the temple, and Mary and her brothers and sisters came in and said, tell Jesus that his mother and brothers and sisters are here, wanting to speak to him. And Jesus said to the messenger, go and tell Mary, go and tell her that my real brothers and my real sisters and my real mothers, my real parents are here listening to my word. And, I mean, if you want to canonize Mary, you should really clean up the Bible a little bit before you do it. Because she was put down in a lot of ways throughout the Bible. And she didn't even follow his teaching. She didn't even know what he taught. And she didn't even care. And yet she picked up a sainthood on the whole thing, which is kind of cute. Now, more about Mary?
What,
in this case, was there not also, as I mentioned, a priest who told to Joseph to take her because she is a God, she is in training and it is from God?
Yes, she had other people in the act, and she knew many people, and she went around to them and said, would they please do these things, and they did for her. Clear?
That's a good story.
Yeah. But hey, it's not a bad thing. It's just that if you goof, you got to cover your butt. As the saying goes, you got to cover your ass. If you goof, you have to do it. Now, it's quite likely that Mary really did have this divine impregnation. Every impregnation is divine, that's for sure. But she probably did. And she probably was a virgin at the time and probably had these things. There's no reason why we shouldn't think she did.
Yeah.
But the thing is, no place does Jesus refer to that. No place does Jesus ever say that of my divine birth, you know. Mm-hmm. He says, I am divine. He says, my Father, meaning God, and He are one, and other good things like that. But he doesn't tout his own horn, which is a wise thing for writers not to have their people do. Because if they blow their own horn, you wonder, is that really so? Is that really true? Or is that just sort of some sort of a joke? Well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Very fascinating. Alrighty, well, it's that time again, and we will have more interesting things if you would like to participate as we go along, and just have a great time. So, know that I love you very much, and I see everything good going into your life in overflowing measure.
Thank you.
The